The 2006 Sunstone Symposium, Dallas, presents Session 6, Old and New Projects, Catching Up with Todd Compton, an interactive conversation with Todd Compton.
Before I introduce Todd, let me once again, for those of you who are somewhat new here, there will be a meeting next Saturday with Richard Bushman here at the house at 7 o'clock. If you would like to come, we'd love to have you. We'll ask for contributions to cover his cost of getting out here. I've got a pad out on the island in the kitchen for your name, phone number, and email address. Get on that, and I can email you for things like this we're doing.
I know it.
We will probably have Greg Prince out in September talking about his biography of David O. McKay. Now, let me say a couple of words about Todd.
Into the mic.
Todd comes to us from California. He lives in the Bay Area. One of Todd's claims to fame was he's been a member of the Miller-Eccles group for years out there, and not only attending as a to listen, but also presenting out there several times. He has his PhD from UCLA in classics, and he is the author of In Sacred Loneliness, which was about the plural wives of Joseph Smith. And so let's turn the time over to Todd.
Thanks. And let me just thank Steve for all those wonderful Miller-Eccles he helped organize over the years. And I remember seeing some of the great talks, that I've seen in my lifetime. I heard Lowell Bunyan at the Miller-Eccles and Leonard Arrington and a number that were just really important to me to hear and see. So I owe him a debt of gratitude, and I think you folks do here too. So. This is a great gathering here. Okay, for my talk today, I wanted to give you just a little introduction to my book that should be coming out in the next month, and then just switch over to In Sacred Loneliness and give you a little background on that and take questions. Okay, so this is the cover of a book that should be appearing in the next month. It's published by Center for Hellenic Studies, which is connected with Harvard University Press. And for me, it's kind of like a mythical book. Will it ever appear? But we think it will appear. We have the cover and the corrected proofs and everything. So to introduce it to you, I have this little PowerPoint presentation, and it's about poet. As you see, poet is scapegoat in the ancient world, and all ancient poets were also prophets. And so, it got me meditating about prophets and how we look at prophets. And one person who's talked a lot about prophets is Nibley. Okay, and one way he talked about prophets in the world is Sophic and Manic. And the way he described these two ways of approaching reality is Sophic comes from Sophos, wisdom, meaning wisdom in a bad sense. Worldly wisdom, spin, public relations, fine oratory, outwardly attractive but often deceptive and harmful, often leads to worldly success and political power, emphasis on truth via rationality. And opposed to that, mantic, from the Greek word mantis, seer, telling the truth without spin or public relations, often outwardly unattractive, often unpopular, often leads to worldly failure, which makes me feel comfortable, you know. Lack of political influence, emphasis on truth via revelation. Okay, and so with that in mind, I wanted to show you some images of how different people have looked at prophets and, you know, look at kind of what the subtext is in how they view prophets. And these next pictures will be very familiar to you. Well, as always, Nibley can oversimplify. So keep in mind what is really mantic. What's the essence of prophethood?
Don? Is there a male-female relationship between those two words? Because I know, like, Sophic and wisdom and so forth is always related to the feminine.
I think they're both male words. I'd have to look at mantis, but I think it's so.
You mean gender, as far as in?
Yeah, all Greek words are male, female, or neuter.
Sophia is the goddess, or
right.
The brevet is related to wisdom. And yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so some familiar pictures. Okay, but what does it tell us about how Arnold Freeberg viewed prophets? Okay, and note how the bad guys are portrayed as related to Nephi there. What are some obvious things that you see right away?
Oh, muscular.
Unkempt.
Well, Nephi is muscular. The bad guys are unkempt. And sorry, Tom, but what do they have?
Long hair.
Long hair. Beards. It's kind of funny. We'll kind of see this pattern. I go through a couple more of these.
He's in a dominant pose.
Yeah, very dramatic pose. Okay, there's Nephi again. Okay, and look at all the other grown-up males. What do they have? They all have beards. But you can see Nephi's biceps, you know, and the others have these spindly little arms. Okay. However, we do have Lehi, who's also a prophet, and so there's kind of, Freeberg kind of has this old prophet, young prophet, and the old prophet can have long white beard blowing in the breeze. Okay. Question, how did Arnold Schwarzenegger get into the Book of Mormon? Ammon defends the flocks. Okay, once again, how is the bad guy characterized?
Hair.
Beard, yeah.
Shorter skirt.
I think Freeberg was a sculptor. He liked to have the full body there, you know. Okay, can you detect any subtle hints of a military theme in this painting? So, he liked the military aspect of prophets. But once again, you know, a very, you know, hefty, dramatic, prophetic figure. Okay, and once again, they're both like Arnold Schwarzenegger figures, even the old prophet this time. And the younger prophet has no beard. The older prophet has the white beard. But even the older prophet, look how well built he is. Okay.
Yeah.
So what is kind of the subtext that we're getting through these pictures? You know, did Hebrew men of that time period really look like that? No. Okay. So
they didn't have McDonald's, they had to.
Well, I mean, you know, I didn't look into the actual dimensions, but I think historically they were a lot smaller than that. And I think Nephi says that he was well built, you know, so. But not that well built. Okay, so what is that telling us about prophets, at least in Arnold Freeberg's view?
Good looking.
Larger than life.
Larger than life, okay. Very idealized. Okay. Okay, now I'm going to turn to my book. How is this prophet characterized visually? This is Aesop. Aesop, who made the fables. And this is a, you know, 16th century book of his fables. There was a story of Aesop, a Hellenistic romance about Aesop, about his life. And in this story, he's a hunchback. And he always has a protruding belly also. Feet are not too attractive. okay, so now I'm just going to go through his story real quickly. This is an actual Greek vase, 450 BC. And he's talking there with a fox, who was a prominent animal in his fables. And notice he has the crutch there. And very big head, and that might be a sign of deformity. It might be dimensions, artistic dimensions, I don't know. Okay, but a very different view of a prophet. Okay, a couple quotes from the romance. He was worthless as a serpent, loathsome to look at, pot-bellied with a deformed head, flat-nosed, mute, dark-skinned, stunted, splay-footed, weasel-armed, squint-eyed, liver-lipped, a portentous blasphemy. How monstrous is his appearance. He's a frog or a hedgehog or a jar with a hump or a captain of monkeys or a little flask or a cook's chest or a dog in a bread basket. I had to translate that from the Greek. It was not easy. All those weird words. Okay, he was a slave. He started out as a slave. And here he's being sold on the market. And notice the more attractive slaves buy him. But you can see his kind of hunchback there and his belly. And I love it how they're all in these medieval German clothes. Okay, Aesop receives speech, epiphany, and early in the Aesop romance, there's two different versions of it, but in the one version, a priestess of Isis comes by, and she's lost and hungry, and he shows her the right way to go, and he gives her food to eat, even though he doesn't have much himself. He's a slave. He's resting beneath the tree there. And so she prays that the goddess Isis will help him. And he can't speak, by the way. He's dumb. And so Isis comes and brings the muses and says, "Look, daughters, at this man, formed in a misshapen way, but who conquers every fault in his piety. This man set my servant on the right road when she had gone astray. I am here with you to reward him. Therefore, I will restore his voice, and you give him the best word for his voice." And this is a really typical epiphany for early Greek poets. They would often receive their mission from a visitation of often the muses, often sometimes Apollo. Okay, so he kind of becomes a sign interpreter, kind of like Joseph in the Old Testament. And so here he interprets a grave inscription and finds a buried treasure for his master. He's still a slave here. And here he's come up in the world. Look how he's dressed. But you can still see his hunchback. And he interprets this mysterious when the eagle drops a ring onto another slave and gains his freedom. Okay, so he becomes famous throughout the world. He travels to the kings of the different nations, and they have this odd kind of warfare where they would send riddles to each other, and the person who couldn't interpret the riddle correctly lost and gave up their kingdom to the other kingdom. And so since Aesop could interpret riddles, he helped the kings who he was allied with. He helped them conquer other kingdoms. And so, from his lowly beginnings, he became very powerful. Finally, he came to Delphi, which is kind of like the spiritual center of Greece. And there's a temple where there's a priestess who gives oracles. And this is where he meets his death. And he goes there, and he gives a display, as he usually does, and the Delphians were very happy to get the display, but they didn't pay him anything. And so he publicly rebuked them, and he said, "I heard you were very generous, but I find I was wrong." And he says, "I'm leaving now, and I'm going to tell everyone else in the rest of the world." And the Delphians said, "Oh, we can't allow this," and because he'll just go all over the place and tell everyone about this. We can't allow it. He was no sooner out of the town upon his journey, but immediately pursued and taken upon the way by the officers and charged with sacrilege. And Aesop denied the matter and laughed at them all for a company of madmen, but upon searching of his boxes, they took the cup. They had hidden a cup from the temple in his bag, and showed it to the people, hurrying him away to prison in the middle of his defense. So they condemn him to die, being thrown from a rock. And on the way to his execution, he takes refuge in the temple of Apollo, and they impiously just drag him away from the altar there. And there he is killed. He's thrown from the cliff. And it's interesting how all the other people are little, but he's still big. And after they do this, the Delphians soon after this were visited with famine and pestilence to such a degree that they went to consult the oracle of Apollo to know what wickedness it had brought these calamities upon them. The oracle gave them this answer, that they were to expiate for the death of Aesop. In the conscience of their barbarity, they erected a pyramid to his honor. So, my book is about poets as scapegoats. And prophets as scapegoats. And so you see how he kind of becomes a scapegoat. kind of ironically, and he's kind of a prophet himself, but ironically in the very center of prophecy in Greece. There was a ritual in Greece, a scapegoat ritual, where they would take an especially ugly person and beat him and throw stones at him, and according to some accounts, he was killed. According to others, he was just chased out of the town. And they did this whenever there was some disaster like a plague or a famine. And we won't go through this. Okay, but what image of the prophet is there as a contrast to Arnold Freeberg's view? You know, very unidealized, at least the way he looks. Okay, so here we have this other mythological creature, Marsyas, who is a satyr and a Silenus, that means about the same thing. And a satyr was half animal, and you can kind of see that with his ears up there. And Marsyas became a famous musician. And in ancient Greece, music meant what we call music, but it also meant poetry, and it also meant dancing. These things are all connected. Okay, and the story about Marsyas is that he boasted that he could beat even Apollo in a musical contest. Okay, and so here, that seems very proud and hubristic, doesn't it? And here's a portrayal of that contest. He's on the right-hand side with his double flute, double pipes, and Apollo is sitting here on the left. And in between is this is all taking place in Turkey. In between is a Phrygian in his Phrygian outfit. And in his right hand, what is he holding? Does anyone know the myth? He's holding a knife. Kind of ominous. Okay. So, according to the story, they kind of went to a standoff. Marsyas was such a great musician. And that's interesting because Apollo is the god of poetry, the god of prophecy. And here's this animalistic satyr who could equal him. However, at one point, Apollo turned his instrument upside down and played on it and demanded that Marsyas do the same. And because it's a pipe, Marsyas couldn't do it. So Marsyas lost the contest on a technicality. Okay, and so the agreement was that either could do whatever they wanted to the other if they lost. And so Apollo flayed Marsyas. And artists, ancient and modern, have been fascinated by this story. And it's very interesting. You know, the question, why? How is Marsyas portrayed here?
He's got the beard.
I hadn't thought about that connection. Is he portrayed as this animalistic, hubristic satyr? How is he portrayed? Sympathetically, unsympathetically. So one of the reasons artists were fascinated by this was because they sympathized with Marsyas. Okay, and so here's a more modern view of the flaying of Marsyas. You see Apollo, he's starting to cut off the skin of his leg. But look at Apollo's face. Very unsympathetic view of Apollo, isn't it? Here's another one. And you can see his legs, they're very animalistic legs at that point. Okay, so one of the reasons I brought this up is because the title of my book is Victim of the Muses, and the Muses are kind of judges of this contest. But the question is, where did Marsyas get his gift? And from the Muses and from Apollo. And he's kind of a scapegoat. Okay, and also because Marsyas has a connection with Socrates. And Socrates is one of the really important kind of prophet scapegoat figures in Greek history. And here's one of the portrayals of him. Is that a heroic portrayal of Socrates?
Well, he was supposedly really ugly.
You're right, yeah. No, his nose is kind of... Yeah, compared to that.
Thick lips.
His eyes are kind of staring. Okay, and here's a description of Socrates in one of the Plato's symposia, one of Plato's dialogues. And he says, Socrates is exactly like the busts of Silenus, which is a satyr, set up in the statuary shop holding pipes and flutes in their mouth, and they are made to open in the middle and have images of gods inside. I say that he is like Marsyas the satyr. You yourself will not deny, Socrates, that your face is like that of a satyr. Aye, and there is a resemblance in other points too. And so here's another portrayal of a prophet. As a Marsyas figure, as a satyr figure. And he goes on to talk about how what a wonderful musician Marsyas was, and how Socrates' talk was musical and magical, like the music of Marsyas. Okay, and here's a couple other poets. I have a chapter about Irish poets in my book, and just a couple wonderful descriptions of poets who, as I say before, are also prophets. Okay, so we have a Mergan. His belly grew until it was the vast size of a big house, and the mucus ran out of his nose into his mouth. His skin was black, his face was pallid, his feet had crooked toes, knobby, bony, scabby his back, and so he was not handsome. Then there's another poet, a foul-faced gilly. When anyone would put his finger on his forehead, a gush of putrid matter would come through his ears on his poll. It seemed to everyone who looked at him that the layers of his brain had broken through his skull. Blacker than death, his face. Swifter than a fox, his glance. Yellower than gold, the points of his teeth. Greener than holly, their base. If the rag that was round him were stripped off, it would not be hard for it to go on a flitting alone, unless a stone were put upon it because of the abundance of its lice. That reminds me of some of the clothes I wore when I was an undergraduate, you know. Okay, so I go ahead and contrast the hyper-idealized view of prophets with the more, and the formalistic view of prophets with the spiritual ethical view of prophets. And I get a lot of that from Lowell Bunyan. And interesting in Leviticus, if you're deformed in any way, you can't be a priest. You can't be a holy person. And again, I think that's a formalistic view of prophets. And it's very important, I think, that we have the non-formalistic view and look at the essence of what prophets are instead of the formalistic, ritualistic view. Okay, and we'll skip over this because I need to go on. There's a nice quote from Lowell Bunyan. I wonder how we would feel if a prophet speaking in the tradition of an Amos or Isaiah would say to us, speaking for the Lord, I hate your baptisms, temple ordinances, priesthood ordinations, your prayers and songs and sacrament meetings. I cannot endure because you love pleasure and material goods more than you love the poor and needy, the sick and afflicted. You know the place of love in the teachings and life of Jesus. So I think it's important to look at the essence of what the prophet is instead of the hyper-idealized view of prophets that we have. And in our culture, sometimes we do have that hyper-idealized and formalistic view. And here's some of the sources of the things I talked about. Okay. So now we'll turn to In Sacred Loneliness. And I'll give you a little introduction to that and answer questions. Oh, by the way, when the book comes out, I hope you'll give it a chance. It's got a lot of interesting things in it. And things that are applicable to our ideas of prophets. And it's kind of like a prehistory of prophets and poets. Yeah?
Who's the intended audience? LDS or beyond LDS?
Both, but, I mean, it's not written specific. There's no mention at all of Mormonism in it.
Okay.
Not of Arnold Freeberg in it.
No mention of Arnold Freeberg in it. But, you know, I think Mormons who are interested in prophets and prophecy will find it really interesting. Okay, In Sacred Loneliness. Here's how I came to write it. I was in classics. I got my degree in classics. When this book I'm just talking about is actually my doctoral dissertation. And after I finished my program, I was kind of looking around for a place to teach, and I had a spare year or two. And a friend of mine was at the Huntington Library and had a fellowship there. Huntington Library is this great library in San Marino, Southern California, near Pasadena. And they have a great Mormon collection because Juanita Brooks helped collect Mormon documents for that library. And so my friend said, Todd, why don't you apply to work on the Eliza Snow Diaries, because they have them here at the Huntington Library. And I thought that was a crazy idea, and because I wasn't in Mormon history, but she gave me all the application stuff, and I looked at it, and it didn't look like it would be too hard to fill out. So I did it, and strangely enough, they gave me a fellowship to work on the Eliza Snow Diaries. So I started working on them and trying to understand them, and I wanted to identify every person in those diaries. And as it turned out, they were later published by Maureen Beecher, a great book that that publishes a lot of her writings. But at that point, nothing had been published about Eliza R. Snow, and she talked about a lot of these women who were her friends, and sometimes she used the first name, sometimes she would use the married name. If they were plural wives, she usually did not use their, you know, the name of her, the plural husbands. So I was faced with a quandary here, how to identify all these women. So I decided I needed a good list of Joseph Smith's wives, a good list of Brigham Young's wives, a good list of Heber C. Kimball's wives, because she had close relationships with all those women. And there were good lists of Heber C. Kimball's wives and Brigham Young's wives, but I couldn't find a good list of Joseph Smith's wives. And the best that there was No Man Knows My History by Fawn Brody. She has an appendix where she lists all of Joseph Smith's wives. But when I started to work with that, it was a good place to start. It was the only place to start, really. Well, the only scholarly work on it. But I thought she really hadn't done a good job. And I thought a lot of the sources she cited were not good, solid sources. And as I continued working on her lists of plural wives, for example, one woman she listed twice, you know, because she married different husbands in her lifetime, and so she included her under one name one time and under another name the other time. She hadn't figured out that she was the same woman. And so there were a number of problems like this. And so I decided I would just create my own list of Joseph Smith's wives. And so when I started doing that, I immediately ran into all kinds of interesting problems and interesting clues. And for instance, a number of Joseph Smith's plural wives were married to other men when Joseph Smith married them. And when I started finding that evidence, I really felt like I needed to figure out what was going on. And so I needed to read all of their diaries and all of their autobiographies and any other important documents related to them to figure out what was going on. And as I started to do that, their life histories became very, very interesting to me. And I got interested in them not just for creating a list of Joseph Smith's plural wives, but for their own lives. And so I ended up writing this book. And I give each of the plural wives a chapter, and published by Signature Books. And I'm really grateful that Signature Books allowed me to write it at the length it is, because you know, I think some publishers might have said, "Okay, Todd, 10 pages per wife," which would have been a reasonable 330 pages. But some of those women are so interesting, and they left so much. So much material that they'd written that I was just really pleased that I was able to like spend 30 or 40 pages on a certain wife. And so some of the great chapters in there are the Partridge sisters, Helen Mar Whitney, and so on and so on. Okay, so what did I find out after I'd done, you know, this little month-long project turned into 5 years of research? What were the conclusions I came to as far as Joseph Smith's wives? I identified 33 women who I felt we had real good, solid evidence that they married Joseph Smith. And the first wife, I feel, was married to Joseph Smith in 1833. Okay, the second wife, we don't have a good date for. But then the rest of the women he married in Nauvoo. And he married a bunch in 1842, and then he kind of stopped, and we think that might be related to the Bennett problems, John C. Bennett problems. And then he started, then he married a whole another bunch in 1843. And then in the like 6 or 7 months before his death, he didn't marry any other plural wives at all that we know of, which is very interesting. And all I can theorize is that there was pressure from anti-polygamy forces in the church or from Emma at that point. He married some women who were older women. He married some women who were young teens. And Helen Mar Whitney was 14 years old when he married her. And however, I believe she's an example of these what we call dynastic marriages. And this is where church, high church leaders kind of make a bond between each other by marrying someone related to the other church leader. So Heber C. Kimball, Helen Mar Whitney. Helen Mar Kimball Whitney was the daughter of, at that time she was Helen Mar Kimball, was the daughter of Heber C. Kimball, an apostle, who was very close to Joseph Smith. And I believe this was kind of a way of bonding the apostle to Joseph Smith at this point. And people always ask about that and all these other marriages, were there sexual relations? And in the case of Helen Mar Kimball, there's no evidence of sexual relations. So, in some of the others we have later, we do have evidence there were sexual relations. So in some of the relationships, there were sexual relations. And there was a case called the Temple Lot case where the Utah Mormon Church was against the RLDS Church in the Midwest. And one of the things they were arguing was, you know, that who was really who really inherited the Church of Joseph Smith? Who really inherited the mantle of Joseph Smith? And so the Utah Church was arguing, well, we have polygamy, which came from Joseph Smith. And so in a court case, they were arguing, you know, Joseph Smith as a polygamist. And they were arguing that these were real marriages, and they included sexual relations. So we have testimony in that court case. Now, isn't Signature bringing out the Temple Lot diaries? Not at this point. I heard that someone was, but the Temple Lot. Yeah, these guys don't know about it. Okay. One interesting thing I found out, I mentioned that Joseph Smith married some women who were married to other men. And of the first 12 women he married, 9 were married to other men. And what I found out after I pieced together the stories as best I could was that they were married to these other men, and they continued to live with these other men, even though they were married to Joseph Smith. And so these are very complex marriage histories. And Zina Huntington, who later married Brigham Young, she had 2 children in Nauvoo, and they were both by her first husband, Henry Jacobs. And however, she was married to Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, and then later in the temple, she was married to Brigham Young. Interestingly, Henry Jacobs stood witness for that second marriage to Brigham Young. And you can read about that in Devery's book. But then after he stood witness, after she was married to Brigham Young for time, then Henry Jacobs took her with him and they started to cross the plains. She had her second child as they were crossing the plains in Iowa in a very difficult childbirth situation. Okay, that gives you a basic overview. Feel free to ask me questions.
Have one just because last week we were talking to Dan and I were talking to Richard Dutcher, and he was on a radio program last week and talking about Joseph Smith's wives, and somebody called in, I think he identified as being fairly young, but just adamant that, you know, you guys are mistaken, Joseph Smith never married plural wives and that. I was wondering if in your research or since you published the book, have you had any feedback from people who are still adamant that none of these marriages ever really took place?
Every now and then you run into someone, sometimes lifelong members of the church, and they have no idea that Joseph Smith had plural wives. And I imagine someone who was very dogmatic might have that point of view, like, no, Joseph Smith never married any plural wives. But I don't run into them so much as I run into people who are just upset that it's been documented that he had this many wives and how, and the way he married plural wives. Every now and then I get a letter like that. And the response is, you know, all kinds of responses to it from all kinds of, you know, all kinds of Mormons, all kinds of non-Mormons. And so some are very upset and some are very thrilled about it, you know, and sometimes conservative people are thrilled about it and conservative people are very upset about it. You know, it just depends on where you're coming from and how you look at it. Here's one little story. A guy emailed me who's related to the people in Colorado City, and he himself, I think, is very standard kind of Mormon and was never involved with fundamentalism or polygamy at all, but he had family members who are involved in polygamy, and including a sister. And he said he was reading In Sacred Loneliness and thinking, oh, if only I could get my sister to read this. And he contacted her, and she was reading the book and was just thrilled about it, you know, like as kind of validating her way of life. So he thought that it would kind of like convince her not to become a polygamist, you know, to stop being a polygamist. And with her, it was like, oh, this book is validating everything about my, you know, my polygamist lifestyle. So different people bring different things to it. Yeah.
Well, I think it's just wonderful that you wrote this book, Todd, because now we're talking about it. Before, you know, it just was like, I mean, it just wasn't something that they talked about that openly. And now that's out of the closet, there's just, you know, it's not the secret anymore. So, you know, you just don't have to hide behind it.
Well, yeah, thanks. I hope it's done a service like that.
Like this, they're talking about it, but mainstream church, most of the folks are aware of polygamy. I mean, the year that we studied Brigham Young, supposedly, and, you know, priesthood and whatever, you know, polygamy never ever came up, and those were severely edited any time it mentioned wives, you know, it was always wife. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's still now members of the church that have virtually no concept of polygamy.
And should I be repeating these comments?
You can, but tell them what your topic of Sons of West is, right there.
Oh, well, this gentleman, whose name I just met, Cody, that's right. Now you're documented. Anyway, he talked about, he says that my book has, yes, you know, some liberals and academics maybe know about my book, but in the general membership of the church, a lot of people still have no clue, you know, that my book is out, or still have no idea what the story is of Joseph Smith Pearl of Wives. And even in our manuals where we talk about Brigham Young and some of these other early polygamous prophets, they kind of leave the polygamy aspect out. And in Sunstone West, we're going to have a little panel where we're going to talk about the polygamous lives of some of these other prophets that have been in the manuals that have been left out. And so, again, hardly anyone will hear that. But
look at the Wilford Woodruff manual right now that I'm teaching in Elders Quorum. They have an outline of his life, and they say, here's the most important events of Wilford Woodruff's life, and not one of his marriages are included, including his first marriage.
Yeah.
And then the lesson on the family has this tearful goodbye with him and his first wife, but they fail to mention that, you know, as he's leaving the Council Bluffs, he's taking his two teenage wives with him, you know, and then, you know.
Right. Another comment on the current manual on Wilford Woodruff, and they just kind of leave his family out of the history. And, you know, all they have to do is just simply say, you know, in some footnotes, say Wilford Woodruff was a polygamist. He married, you know, he married 11 wives. Let's say 10. He married 10 wives. And these are their names. All they have to do is stick that in at the end of the book or something like that. And all of this would have been nothing we would even talk about, you know. Tom, okay, we'll let you have one more.
I know that 11 of the wives of Joseph's wives married Heber. And I understand that 11 of the wives married Brigham.
Yeah, about, okay. Yeah.
Where's the other 11 wives?
Well, this is a good question. 11 wives married Heber C. Kimball. About 11 wives married Brigham Young. What happened to the other 10 wives? Okay, and so this is one of the interesting aspects of my book, is that it looks at the women after Joseph Smith died and, what the rest of their life histories were like, and all kinds of various outcomes. And some left the church. Some left Mormonism and left the church. And one of the most interesting ones is Agnes Coolbrith, who came to California, and her daughter Ina, who took the name Ina Coolbrith, became a very famous poetess in like the Gold Rush in California. And she's one who left the church, partially over polygamy. Sometimes they married other church leaders. Amasa Lyman married one of the Partridge sisters. Sometimes they married just ordinary people, like you and me. all of these outcomes. Yes.
How do you handle his wives before they were his wives? What about the very beginning, before he was actually married? I mean, do you go into that?
Okay, the question is, how do I deal with the wives' relationships before they married Joseph Smith? Joseph Smith relationships. Well, the way I looked at this book was not through the viewpoint of Joseph Smith, but through the viewpoint of the women. Okay, and which really frustrates some people who feel like my point of view should have been Joseph Smith all the time. But I wrote this as a feminist. You know, it's feminist history from the viewpoint of women. So for each of the women, I look at their life history before they met Joseph Smith, and their life history as they got to know Joseph Smith, and then the marriage to Joseph Smith, you know, and then what few details we have about their life with Joseph Smith, and then after his death, you know, a full view of their life histories after Joseph Smith. So... And they just had typical Mormon backgrounds, you know, like their families converted, and often they were there in Kirtland and Missouri and Nauvoo, and sometimes they were single women and they converted and came to Nauvoo. So they had various histories, very interesting lives, many of them. Yes?
Why are you calling the book In Sacred Loneliness?
When I got done with the book, I kind of had a view of polygamy based on these 33 women who I'd dealt with. And 33 women is not enough to have a real, you know, total view of Mormon polygamy. But I began to read other books about Mormon polygamy and kind of felt like some of the patterns I saw in these 33 women were the patterns you saw in other polygamous marriages also. And what was really striking to me was the fact that they were often alone. And, you know, that makes sense. The bigger the family a man would have, the less time he would be able to devote to these women. And, boy, did anyone see that A&E special about polygamy?
Yeah.
2 hours the other night? According to them, there were some modern polygamists who had so many wives and children that they didn't spend time with their kids, you know. And that seems crazy to us.
Well, how could you if you had more than one? You're working 8 hours a day. All these women come home to at night.
Yeah. And so Brigham Young had 56 wives, though a number of them kind of left him. So he never had, like, 56 living in the Lion House, but he still had a number. And so even if you have just, like, 30 who you're actively working with as members of your family, think about, you know, supporting financially, spending time with as part of your family, you know, that really limits how much time you can spend with each wife and each of these kids. And one of the striking diaries I found was the diary of Emily Partridge, who was a wife of Brigham Young. And she had a terrible time with Brigham Young. And she would have these agonized entries in her diaries about, how am I going to get this money to pay this bill? You know, she was a prophet of the church, but I think in monogamy you wouldn't have that kind of situation. You know, I think that's kind of part of the experience of polygamy. So, to get back to your question, I found a lot of these women did have feelings of loneliness and neglect just because of how polygamy is set up. However, it was seen as very sacred. If you read history in the 19th century of the church, you find that that's a very central part of our church doctrine. And so it was viewed as very sacred. And so you have this paradox. So that's kind of my interpretation of the experience of polygamy for these women, you know, which is sacred loneliness. Yeah.
Regarding sexual relations, everyone always asks the question, where are all the children at? Through my research, some names have been changed, but can you expound upon that a little bit?
Yeah. Question is,
how do they have sex when they have so many kids?
No.
Where are Joseph Smith's children? Okay, if there were sexual relations. Okay. We'll start with that question, and hope that everyone has forgotten that question by the time I'm done with Aaron's question. The way I deal with it is Joseph Smith's I have a term I call Utah polygamy practical polygamy. Okay, it was open; people knew about it. The husbands were openly supporting these wives, and they were openly having children. Okay, In Nauvoo, it was secret polygamy. It was not practical polygamy. And Joseph...
The women were married to and still live with their first husbands.
Right. So right there, you see there's an issue where, you know, it's not a normal marriage. Where you have frequent sexual relations. And so Joseph Smith's marriages were not normal... normal practical polygamous marriages like we know in Utah. Okay, there is testimony, even legal testimony, that there were sexual relations, but they were not frequent, I don't think, as far as I can tell. And so that's basically how I deal with it. I say one issue is Joseph Smith had to deal with Emma also. Emma was never sympathetic to polygamy. She kind of wavered on it at times, but even if she kind of wavered toward allowing it, she would go right back and be totally against it and, you know, be watching Joseph Smith. So that also is not normal for Utah polygamy. You know, all of the prophets in Utah, they had first wives who dealt with it, but Emma never really came to terms with it. There is an affidavit. There's affidavit evidence for one child of Joseph Smith. And this is from one of those, what I call polyandrous marriages. And her name's Josephine, the affidavit is by Josephine Fisher, and Josephine Fisher said that on her mother's deathbed, and her mother was a wife of Joseph Smith, her mother told her that she, Josephine, was a child of Joseph Smith. Okay, and so some people deal with that by saying, well, I don't believe it. You know, but I accept that myself. So I accept Josephine Fisher, Josephine Lyon Fisher, as a child of Joseph Smith. So we do have one documented child of Joseph Smith. Another of the wives, Mary Rollins Leitner, in her later life, she said that she knew other children of Joseph Smith who were raised under other names. Okay, so according to at least Mary Leitner, there were other children, you know, but they were not raised as children of Joseph Smith. And Josephine Fisher was not raised knowing she was a child of Joseph Smith either. And again, this is part of the secrecy of Nauvoo polygamy.
There's probably only so many children that were born in that, say, 4 or 5 year period from this group of women. Probably wasn't that many, you know, potential children,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, the comment is that it was a short period and not a lot were born. And as I mentioned before, a number of them, about a third of them, were married to other husbands, and they were not, you know, and I believe they were cohabiting with their, having sexual relations with their first husbands. And that was the case with Zinah Diantha Huntington, to give her full name, Dinah Zantha Huntington Jacobs Smith Young. Yeah. Someone was quicker than me back there. And she was the Third Relief Society president of the church. You know, and some people think, why bring up all of these stories about Joseph Smith and polygamy? And one thing is, Joseph Smith is a major figure. I mean, he's a major figure in American history. You just can't ignore his wives or, you know, the doctrine of polygamy. It's there. You got to deal with it somehow. And second, these are really important women in Mormon history. And their marriage to Joseph Smith were very important. Eliza R. Snow is another one who was a wife of Joseph Smith. Deb?
I was thinking of ignoring it. I've seen a new movie on Joseph Smith, the Joseph Memorial Building, from what I hear. Somehow they were able to overlook it. So the 33 that you've documented are definites. Are there some...
I consider them definite.
Didn't quite fit in, but you think might be, and if so, are you still researching these to try to...
Yeah, the question is, the 33 I consider pretty solid. Are there others who are maybes? And I have a list of about 10 who I consider possible. I call them possible wives of Joseph Smith. And I think you could really make good cases for some of them. And other scholars other than me have accepted them as plural wives of Joseph Smith. And I've just been, I just erred a little bit on the side of conservatism, I think. And so I've continued to do a little work on them, but not a lot of work. So I haven't found documentation that really puts them over into the 33 category yet. But
so if you were to do a second edition, it would still be 33?
Yeah, I think so. But it's like, for the ones I put in the 33 category, you know, you might have 5 or 6 good pieces of evidence that they were Joseph Smith's plural wives. Or a really solid, you know, autobiography where they talk about marrying Joseph Smith. In these others, you might have just one piece of evidence, one late piece of evidence. And, you know, that may turn out, but I just want a little bit more than that one little late piece of evidence. So I would be happy if someone else goes after those 10 possible wives and really nails them down. Yeah.
So were these women aware of each other, and what was their, if they were, what was their relationship with each other?
They, you know, it's like not every one of the 33 knew about every other of the 33, but you know, you might have 10 or 15 who knew about each other, and were good friends, and they were, if you go into the history of polygamy and look at what the relationships between plural wives were like, it was similar to that, I think. I think they considered themselves sister wives and had really good relationships and supported each other. And I think they kind of felt like they were part of a very elite inner group of followers of Joseph Smith, you know, as they were. People like Eliza R. Snow and Zinah Huntington just kept had very, very close relationships for the rest of their life. And Patty Sessions is another very close relationship with Eliza Snow the rest of their life. And they knew it. They knew about each other. Though not everyone. Not everyone knew all of the 33.
In the know of all of them.
No. No. And I think that's one of the traditions of Mormon polygamy, that there is this kind of this ideal that you do everything by checking with the first wife first, and the first wife agreed to it, and then, and that was an ideal that sometimes they just ignored. And they married plural wives without the first wife even knowing, or without asking questions. And at the funeral of Heber C. Kimball, at the funeral of Valate Kimball, who was the first wife of Heber C. Kimball, and Heber C. Kimball married about 46 wives. And Heber C. Kimball himself said, "And I married many plural wives, and many of them she didn't know about." And so there was this ideal that they should know, but often they didn't know. And so I think definitely we know with the Partridge sisters, Joseph Smith had married them, and then Emma came around to polygamy and said, "Okay, I'll let you have plural wives if you'll let me select them." And so Joseph Smith said, "Okay, go ahead." And she selected the Partridge sisters. So that's kind of embarrassing because he'd already married them. So they had remarriages. So we have two marriage dates for each of the Partridge sisters, which, you know, history of polygamy is full of little odd things like that. Well, genealogy is full of odd little things like that. Yeah.
Actually, it's full of lies as well. We don't like to say that, though. But
I call them public truth conflicts. Yeah.
The first wives agreed, and in some cases they actually did. And I know that,
yeah.
And I know that all cases were not, that there weren't bad relationships between the women, but there certainly were a lot. And you know, when you're told as a first wife that you're going to go to hell if you don't, or that you'll burn or whatever, even as Joseph Smith said to Emma, I don't know what kind of, if we really call that agreement.
Yeah, and so this comment was about how difficult it was for first wives to disagree to her husband taking plural wives. If sometimes they were, Emma was threatened with damnation, and there was just an incredible amount of community pressure that could be put on a first wife who was holding out against a man taking a plural wives. And often, you know, it was viewed as a religious duty in Mormon culture. And so often, if you were called to a high church position and were a monogamist, that was one of the things. They said, "Okay, now we want you to take a plural wife," even if you wanted to or not. And you said another thing about sometimes first husbands did check with the first wife, and that's true. Often they did work with the first wife and try to do it, you know, in such a way to, you know, within the way the first wife would want it done. And in the history of polygamy, we have some wonderful stories about, you know, husbands and plural wives who tried to make it work and really did a good job. You know, we have other stories that are extremely tragic, and polygamy was very difficult because, as I mentioned before, if you're a husband and you have 10 wives, it's very hard to kind of split up your resources and your time with each of these 10 wives. And one thing that happened was, which is a very natural human thing, is that sometimes the husbands had favorite wives. And it was tough on the wives who weren't the favorite wives. Has anyone read Giant Joshua?
Yeah.
You get some of these patterns there. Yes.
The doctrine behind this, as I understand it, during that period of time, was that the woman that was attached to the high priesthood holder, this gave her an entry into the celestial kingdom.
Yeah, I think both male and female, the idea was you needed to practice polygamy to enter into the highest part of the celestial kingdom. And there was also the concept that the more wives you had, the bigger your family, the greater your glory would be and exaltation would be in the next life. Clayton taught that Joseph Smith taught that. William Clayton taught that Joseph Smith taught that. So it's kind of ironic if you think that the more wives someone had, the lower the quality of their family life. You know, it's like the more post-life exaltation you have, the lower the quality of your family life in this life. These horrible paradoxes that Mormons were faced with. Jack.
Yeah, I have a question. Last question. Excuse that the ancient prophets had wives, right? Didn't they have concubines? And what's the difference between a wife and a concubine?
I didn't really get into this much, but you're right. The ancient prophets had wives and concubines. But let me bring up the fact that sometimes people...
Concubines are better looking ones?
No. Concubines didn't have the full status of the full wives, and I don't know much about that myself.
So you got turned in section 132.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Leah and Bilhah were servants to their...
Yeah, that's right.
I think that is probably the difference. It was a servant-free woman relation kind of difference.
That's true. But I didn't get into this. I didn't do research on this for In Sacred Loneliness. However, one thing that is important is people often ask me, why did polygamy start? And I believe it was because Joseph Smith was very impressed by the example of these Old Testament prophets, Abraham and Jacob, Israel, were polygamous. And Joseph Smith was very close to Abraham. And we have the Book of Abraham, and Abraham is important in DNC 132. Okay, so that's the answer I give when people ask me why the beginning of polygamy. I think it was a religious thing, you know, that Joseph Smith saw as part of the restoration of the gospel that needed to be restored in our day. Sorry.
Go ahead.
One question. How many... did he contract before he got the revelation? The polygamy with revelation.
Oh, well, this is another good thing. Remember, I told you I date the first marriage at 1833. Okay. That's Fanny Elger. Fanny Elger.
And actually, I heard that the personal ancestry file, the church's ancestry file, they've recently added Fanny Elger to the list of his wives.
Interesting. So the church's ancestral file, yeah, if you're interested, you can go see how they do have a list of Joseph Smith's wives, you know, and like the ancestral file is just full of mistakes, but it's useful. So it's interesting to see what they come up with. And Andrew says that they just added Fanny Elger to his list of wives. That's interesting. I think that he began receiving, depending on how you view Joseph Smith and how you view revelation in his life, he began, you know, receiving revelation on it in the early 1830s, 1831, 1832, 1833. You know, in the DNC 132, that was like, what? When was that, 1843? But that wasn't the first revelation he had on it, in my view. Okay.
But is it written down in the is it in the book, the DNC, these other revelations?
No.
No.
Yeah. No. Okay.
I have a question. Whenever we talk about this, the man always gets the rap for it. He's going out getting these women. But it appears to me that when you study it, the women are after the prophet. And Joseph Smith, after he died, they were a bunch of them being sealed to him because they wanted to be his wives. He wasn't putting any heat on them to become my wives. And then later on, they reversed all those sealings because they said he ought to have a voice in who he's marrying. But I think we've got to give the man a little bit of leeway here. It's not all his doing.
Okay, hopefully he's so close that came over the mic. In the history of polygamy, you have all kinds of stories. You have women who were attracted to high church leaders, and you have high church leaders who were very attracted to women. And sometimes the attraction was spiritual. Sometimes it was very practical. It was like a bishop who, you know, there's a widow in his ward who needs to be taken care of, and he married her to give her support. And all kinds of stories in the history of polygamy. And so you do find... women who wanted to enter polygamy. You find women who were thrilled about the idea of polygamy and were thrilled about the husband they were able to marry. I have one friend who just hates polygamy. Just hates the idea of polygamy. You know, a big Bruce Springsteen fan, and I said one time, now, if you could be Bruce Springsteen's second wife, would you embrace polygamy for that? And she stopped and thought about it. So you have all kinds of stories. And you do have, you have stories where women were horrible to other women in Mormon polygamy. And you have stories where the men were really good, trying to be really good leaders and trying to divide their time equally between the wives and their children. It's a fascinating history and fascinating chapter in Mormon history. Yeah. Stop. Well, should we stop now?
Tom and I agreed before, and we're flexible on how long our last session goes. And so if this has still some energy, let's go for it for a few more minutes.
Tell you what, let's do the last. Well, this is the last one, so we can get to yours.
And you can take it. Take the questions during the break.
Right.
This might be a good final question because it's more from a popularity standpoint. There are many news outlets, including some of the big ones, 2020, Dateline, that pick up on these kinds of books, the releases, and it's very feasible that you could be approached and asked to give scholarly opinion on some of these things. And obviously that could be positive or more likely negative from the PR relationship with the church. And it's very possible that the scenario could become where you would be sort of giving your results of study and then there might be representative from the church sort of in an antagonistic setting where it's sort of you against them or different viewpoints. If given that situation, I realize that's maybe far-fetched, but also could potentially bring you quite a bit of notoriety. But if put in that adversarial position with the church, would you take that opportunity, or would you feel that it wasn't your job to bring a negative?
Gee, we've run out of time. Oh, wow, this is a real probing question.
I've written four papers, and I have a master's thesis I've written, and I know that the search for truth is based in research. We have evidence-based knowledge today, and I see that in your work. But at the same time, we talked earlier before you started speaking that how nice it would be to sell 100,000 copies of your book. you make your living.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, if given the adversarial position with the church, how would you handle that? Because there are so many members of our church who find themselves in apostate positions.
Okay, well, I don't worry about the book selling. Okay, that's not even an issue. You know, like, I'm happy if it does. You're right, it's a bonus. Okay, but the adversarial position. I basically feel that honest history helps the church. You know, it's the very best thing that can happen to them. You know, and if there's a difficult issue, it's helping them to bring it out so you can talk about it, you know, so it isn't like a wound that's festering. And that's one of the things I really admire about Juanita Brooks, is she, you know, she brought it out in the open so you could talk about it. And so I think in the long run and the short run, it's the best thing to do is to be as honest as you can. You're not trying to be anti-Mormon or, you know, not trying to attack, but you're trying to be as balanced as possible, but deal with a problem issue. And I've tried to do that to the best I can. And so I think, you know, being honest that way helps the church. So I wouldn't feel like I was being adversarial, but I would just try to be as honest as possible. And I would feel that I was helping the church in that situation. Obviously,
you said that that your book was a much more balanced approach than the others that have been put out there. He was sort of the de facto church historian at the time.
For a little while, my book was cited on the official church website. And after a couple months, they took it off. they took that citation off, but it was Richard Turley who cited it.
Book.
Yeah. Okay, we better quit. Yeah. Feel free to ask me other questions.